Ah, hiya, Sid. Come on in.
Morning, Billy. What gives?
You know as much about it as I do.
Do you know anything about it, Griselda?
No. All I know is he asked you all to come round to hear an announcement he has to make. I think it's another of his important ones.
He's got his chair up on a dais with the flags draped behind him, has he?
That's right.
I wouldn't mind if he had something important to announce. What was his last proclamation to the world?
The extra 2 foot on his back garden is his last territorial claim in East Cheam.
Ah, yeah, that's right.
Hey, tell me, do you think he's gone off his bonce again?
Oh, no, you know how impressionable he is. He just gets carried away. I'd sooner have him like this than he was after he saw Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, drinking all that rubbish he was concocting. He was in bed for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
He summoned the gentlemen of the press as well this time. All the national dailies have been asked to attend.
Must be something big.
Shh, quiet, quiet. I think he's on his way in.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Likes of Us podcast with me, your host Neil Bradley, dedicated to working class life, art, politics and culture. A break from the norm this weekend. It's not my usual episode. That will return on Thursday when I look at part 3 of my life at the Daily Mirror, when I first get to encounter the lunatic that was Robert Maxwell. But until then, this episode is just a short one, and it's dedicated to a week in the life of the Open Book Project at Goldsmiths College. And the reason being that a few nights ago, we went to the Grosvenor House Hotel in Park Lane for a swanky affair in Mayfair, because we'd been nominated, shortlisted, for an award in the Times Higher Education Awards and in the category of widening participation. Now, earlier in the year, we won in the same category the Guardian Award, which was great. So, fingers crossed with this one, because it would have made a nice bookend, I think, and cemented really what has been a great year for Open Book and the work that's done at Goldsmiths and in Chatham and the other universities that we have a sort of presence. So I hope you enjoy this episode. So back to normal come Thursday. Keep the faith and enjoy. Okay, a little bit of a break from the norm today. I'm in Goldsmiths College and it's the student open day. So there are plenty of people walking around aimlessly and looking nervous and excited. And the reason being, we've got Open Book has its own stall, trying to encourage people from non-traditional backgrounds into higher education. And it's really strange. I'm sitting watching the main entrance door and I can tell our people as they come through the door. I just know, I sort of hone in on them. And earlier I met a young girl with her parents, very working class. She would be the first in family to go to university, and they were looking perplexed and very much three fishes out of water. And I took her to the place she wanted to be, and they was really pleased with that, I think, and I had a little chat with them and offered them a little bit of reassurance and give them my card and asked them to get in touch if she needed any help with her application. And in terms of like preparation for coming to somewhere like Goldsmiths, and in the hope that she doesn't drown, which is often the case with our students, it was certainly the case with me when I studied here. So I'm just going to go into the Great Hall, they call it. So it's going to be a little bit noisy, so excuse me, that hopefully the recording comes out okay. Now, I think 150 years ago, Goldsmiths College was the Royal Naval College, and the Great Hall now has a sort of roof on it, and it's a big square sort of a yard type room with an enormous pipe organ, which I've never heard anyone play. But I think in back in the time when it was a naval college, there was no roof on the top and it was an open square. And the reason it's the shape and the size it is because it was a marching square when naval officers were on parade, and it's as the perfect measurements for a marching square. Nobody's probably even aware of that, but I think if you ever come past Deptford Town Hall, you'll notice a ship on top of the tower, which is like acts as a weather vane, connecting it with its sort of, you know, Royal Navy pass. So I'm just about to enter into the fray now and go and find my colleagues at the open book desk. It's curious, everywhere else has got a queue waiting to speak to somebody, and our table is fully manned but sat empty. I think everyone's terrified of us, you know. They're all heading to the widening participation desk, but we are the paramilitary wing of widening participation, and so I'm just going to sit down now and let them give me some advice about applying for university. Looking around, it's obvious I'm the only oik in the building. More in a while. Okay, I'm still in the Great Hall at Goldsmiths. It's quietening down a little bit. Still plenty of people here. But we've not had a lot of footfall today, which really is one of the arguments that we're actually making. You know, I would assume that the majority of the people coming through our doors are either privileged, or they were already making that journey into higher education almost as a rite of passage. And working class applicants and their parents, who are like, again, like fishes out of water, are few and far between. And that's something we really do have to change. I think one element of modern day university life, and which has taken universities by surprise, I think, has been not only the introduction of high fees across the board, but also the fact that everybody seems to have bought into this new sort of fee structure. And despite what you may read or hear in the news, universities are actually sort of experiencing a sort of boom time in higher education. It seems that people have accepted the introduction of fees completely, despite some of those early, student protests. Now, for me, I mean, you know, I'm fundamentally opposed to university fees. But the worrying aspect for me is that it seems to have had the desired effect in terms of non-traditional students. Because they simply aren't buying into it regardless of any claim made by the coalition government and government, the government now, that, you know, you don't pay anything up front and you only start paying back student fees, you know, student fee loans once you've started working. Now, what they never took into account was a working class tradition, even though that's changed somewhat now in, you know, in terms of consumerism and everything that's shiny. But traditionally, working class people did not like to get into debt. And the whole ethos of modern day higher education is that from the very beginning, you sign up for debt. You know, with the sort of proviso that, you know, somewhere down the line, that debt will be paid back tenfold by way of a professional salary. And to be honest, there's no evidence of that. So, yeah, that's worrying for us. And it's really strange because I was listening to some social history audio a few days ago, and there was a speech which I might try and include in this podcast, where the speaker was talking about a dumbing down, you know, the usual thing. Too many people are going to university, not the right type of people going to university, and there obviously must be a lowering of standards. And there must be a, you know, there must be a kind of dumbing down going on. Now, what they mean by that? Now, this was in the 60s, when working class people first started benefiting from that post-war Labour government that was trying to introduce, you know, higher education for all. And we started getting the first recipients in the late 50s and 60s of people going to, you know, polytechnics and higher education institutes. Now, what they mean by dumbing down and the wrong type of people, I think they mean us. And it's always assumed that when the likes of us start attending universities and achieving academically, that it must have somehow become easier, which is really offensive, you know. And the same argument was made post-Blair's, you know, education decade, when the government suddenly decided, you know, there's too many people going to university and it's unsustainable. Again, I think what they meant was that there's too many of us going to university now, even though, you know, there was an increase, but nowhere near the increase that, you know, there should be, if we're going to bring about real change in society and make this particular route a sort of viable one for us and the likes of us. But as I say, fees, by the looks of it, are here to stay. They're only going to get higher, and the higher they go, regardless of whether you pay up front or you're saddled with student debt for the rest of your life, there's no doubt it will discourage working class people from going into higher education, you know. And the argument they'll make is that we're not stupid, which is sort of ironic. So, more in a while.
I think the trouble is that our universities now are a bit overextended. There are too many of them. They've come too quickly. It means a certain lowering of standards, I think, in the staffing of them. It must do. And the result is that quite a number of people have got into them who ought not to be at universities at all. I mean, it's quite easy to get. And that is having a disastrous effect on what you might call the student image, because most students don't do these things. But the trouble is, you see, in certain faculties, it's very easy to get into a subject which doesn't need an intensive intellectual discipline. I would think sociology was one. I would think perhaps English was one. And it's very pleasant, if you're mildly interested in those subjects, get the necessary number of A-levels and get a place in a university, and then have 3 years, perhaps more, at the public expense. And I think a lot of people are now doing that. And I think there will come a time when the taxpayer will ask why.
Okay, I've abandoned the car today and on Shanks's pony because I'm over near Russell Square going to Senate House. Now, I don't know if you know this building. It's like, if you get a chance to go over that part of London, just go and check it out. It's a brilliant building. This like Art Deco, it sort of rises out of the ground, you know, from, you can see it from Tottenham Court Road. Legend has it that Hitler, when he planned the invasion of Britain, had Senate House earmarked as his the headquarters for the Nazi Party in Britain. You can sort of see why. I mean, it looks like it's been designed by Albert Speer. Also, I understand that George Orwell, in 1984, the book 1984, he envisaged Senate House as being the building that contained the Ministry of Love. And which is quite ironic, I'm going there today. There'll be loads of love there today. Now we're taking part today, and when I say we, I mean the Open Book Project at Goldsmiths College. We're taking part in a festival, Being Human. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I've looked through there, some of the itinerary, and it looks like a lot of old pretentious bollocks to me, I've got to tell you. It's very strange. The academic world is very strange because of the fact that they spend hours and hours and hours researching us and gathering in rooms to talk about us. And they write these... you know, tombs of research papers about us, and yet whenever there's an event where they present this research, none of us are actually there, and everybody applauds and pats them on the back. It's a sort of like a, it's like a bit of a fantasy world, if you ask me. It's a strange place. It's a strange place for... and I'm talking about the academic world. It's a strange place for us to exist in, really, because... it's the perfect place for us to exist in. Because we are constantly challenging... you know, sociologists and anthropologists as to their research and as to the stuff they've written about us. And but today though, we're we've been invited in as part of our collaboration with our sort of major funder, Lankelly Chase, and an organisation called Rising Minds. And there's others, you know, Unlock, which we've sort of had a close association with, certainly in the past. And so today we're exhibiting student artwork, student writing, some of the stuff that's been created in our creative writing classes, and a few of us are going to talk. I plan to read an excerpt from my memoir, Four Funerals and a Wedding. And just give a little talk about how that came about, this particular chapter that I'm going to read. Looking forward to that. Now, big day for us today, because along with this event this evening, we are gathering at the Grosvenor House Hotel in Park Lane with our glad rags on, because it's the Times Higher Education Awards, you know, and they're described as the British Oscars of the British higher education sector, and we are shortlisted for an award in the category of widening participation and equality. Now, we already won earlier this year in the same category in the Guardian Awards, so it would be nice to bookend the year and really cement this as the year of open book. But so fingers crossed, but I'll give you more of an update later on at that event, and I'll give you more of an update on this event as soon as I can find the room and find all my fellow open bookers who will all be standing out like sore thumbs. Okay, more in a while. Now, as part of the Being Human exhibition at Senate House, open book, staff members and students were asked to contribute some work, artworks. So I have a couple of typed installations hanging in Senate House. And I was also asked to make a contribution to the gathering and either give a talk about the project or about my own personal experience. What I actually chose to do was read from the last chapter of my memoir, Four Funerals and a Wedding, Journeys in Creative Writing. Because the festival was called Being Human, and our particular contribution was on the theme of hopes and fears. And I think this particular chapter encapsulates that perfectly. So this is the reading. Okay, when I was thinking about today, I wasn't quite sure what to say, really. But I went back and looked at some writing that I'd done, and this seems to, I think, fit the bill. I think talking about hopes and fears. Just some backstory. My mother died of cancer, and years later, my dad had a heart attack, like one of four heart attacks, and I think it was in the days after my dad had his last heart attack that I actually wrote this piece. It's called The Carrier Bag. Years back, my dad is speaking in hushed tones on the telephone, shaking his head with the shame of it. He says he wants to be a writer, he tells whoever's on the other end of the line. I think he might be having a breakdown or something. Either that, or he's smoking the funny fags, or he's gone gay. I always found it curious, my dad's response to my wanting to write. When I was at school, he got himself elected as a school governor at the secondary school I attended, a position usually reserved, especially back in the 1970s, for doctors, solicitors, architects and the like. Naturally, my dad was proud of this new position, especially boasting the fact that he was a toilet cleaner by way of his profession. Compared to most of the other dads I knew, the dads of the boys I went to school with, the dads of those that lived on the same council estate as us, he was always really enlightened. He was certainly always challenging the system, believing that we had the right to be whoever and whatever we wanted to be. And yet, years later, when I made that declaration about wanting to write, he seemed so dismissive, worried even, worrying that such a pursuit would bring me, him, nothing but trouble. I'd been writing for about a year, with none of it making much sense, or I'd suddenly started having a lot of letters to the editor published in a variety of men's magazines, Arena, FHM, Maxim, GQ, and was happily stockpiling an array of prizes for my efforts. Sharon got a Mont Blanc pen, my mother another pen of similar value and stature. At the time, everyone, my mother, Sharon, my brothers, seemed really proud, if somewhat surprised, although my dad continued in his reluctance to even talk about the subject of my writing, let alone embrace the concept, or at least so I thought. One day, by chance, looking through the drawers in my parents' dining room cabinet, I discovered a collection of magazines in which I'd had letters published and for which I'd been awarded prizes. "What's all this?" I asked. "Your dad bought those," my mother said, smiling from the kitchen. "What?" I was incredulous. I simply couldn't envisage my dad in a local newsagent's leafing through the pages of those magazines in search of evidence of my craft. "Don't mention it to him," my mother warned. It was strange, although very working class, his buying those magazines in secret, although even in recent years, whenever I've written anything, my dad's praise for my work has always come via a third party, Sharon usually. A few weeks after the discovery of those magazines, I was back over at my parents' house, making preparations to drive back to Camberwell Green, Sharon and I having enjoyed Sunday lunch with the pair of them. My dad meanwhile was out in the hall preparing himself for a walk up the woods with the dog, putting on a thick scarf, ski hat, heavy coat, Wellington boots. "I'll see you later, Dad," I called to him. He'd already made his goodbyes and was heading for the front door. "There's a carrier bag in the dining room for you," he called back. I wait until I hear the door close behind him, before getting up from the sofa and going into the dining room to investigate. Upon the dining room table was a Daily Telegraph carrier bag, which looked as if it were full to bursting. "What's this?" I called to my mother. She sat in the armchair, smiling. "Your dad's got you some stuff from work." Opening the bag, I discover a collection of pens, reporters' notepads, post-it notes, along with an entire year's worth of the Daily Telegraph's arts and books section. He'd saved every one for me, all any aspiring writer needed, surely. "What is it?" Sharon asks, and I hold up the pads and pens towards her, shaking my head at my dad's gesture, the physical proof of his approval in terms of my craft. Sharon looks over at my mother, and they both share a smile. "Come on, let's go," I say. As we busy ourselves with putting on our coats and gathering together our belongings, my mother waits in the hallway by the front door. "Bye, Doreen," Sharon says, kissing my mother. "Bye, Mum," I say, copying the gesture. "See you next week." As we walk the short walk down the garden path, my mother stands watching us. We turn and wave. She waves back and then closes the front door on another Sunday. Sharon grips my hand and we walk around the corner to where the car is parked. Everything seems hopeful. Okay, so we've just had our Being Human event, which seemed to go down reasonably well, you know. Lots of confused looking people who don't know open book or don't quite understand open book. But it all went well. Hopefully the recording of my book reading came out. So everyone's sort of dashing away now because they've got to go and get their glad rags on for the award ceremony tonight. And more later. Now, we're just, as I say, we're in Senate House, so we're all going to go down and have a look and see if we can find Room 101, which features in 1984. From what we can gather, George Orwell worked in this building for the BBC. So it was an obvious inspiration. Okay, so more in a while. Now, one of the universities that we are up against tonight in these awards is the Conservatoire Scotland. And I'm looking across at a table full of these men in kilts and tartan trews. I was going to give them a rendition of Sunshine on a Leaf. It's very strange. The Scots are very strange people, because they seem to be very proud of wearing their, their family tartan, which makes you wonder, we should have come dressed as chimney sweeps or pearly kings. Or I could have put on my white forensic suit, which I used to wear when I go down the tunnels to clean ink, and add me size 12 Wellington boots and me goggles and me respirator. That would have been great. And a rope around my waist, dragging along a rubber bucket full of congealed ink in case it becomes combustible. It could certainly get combustible if we don't win. There you go. More in a while. Okay, so we're on to the second course now. No sign of Richard E. Grant. He's fucking nowhere to be seen. He's over at the road, over Park Lane in a winter wonderland. I can't tweet. Look, all the other universities have managed. We've got no IT skills or anything. How are we up for an award? I don't know what's going on. More in a while.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I assume you've had the finest wines available to humanity here.
Yeah.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, please settle down and behave yourselves. I'll introduce each category and invite a presenter to join me up here on stage, and then I'll tell you a little about the finalists. As I do so, their photos will appear on the screen behind me. Our presenter will then open the golden envelope and announce who will be walking off with one of these delightful trophies you see behind me. And once the announcement has been made, Trish Bertram, up there on the balcony, will tell you a little about why they've been honoured. We'll be doing this 19 times. And although we'd love to hear from you all, we have no time for acceptance speeches. So we'd like you just to come up to the stages, smile for the camera, and then return to your table with the rapturous applause of your peers ringing in your ears. We will make just one exception to the no speech rule at the very end when we ask the winner of our University of the Year to say a few words. The runners-up in each category won't leave empty-handed either. All of those will receive a certificate posted out by THE in the next week or so. What's better than a month?
Okay, so this is our award now. I'm certainly hoping it's going to be us. Big disappointment if it's not.
Yes, I'll be charging for that later. Let's take a look at those in the running.
Here we go.
The V16 project at the University of Essex sees the institution working closely with six schools in areas with some of the lowest university progression rates in the country. Focus West, based at the University of Glasgow, provides information and offers advice to Scottish support pupils in 37 Scottish secondary schools as they progress along the path to higher education. Goldsmiths University of London offers the open book service to former offenders and those whose addiction or mental health issues mean that they have never considered higher education. Liverpool John Moores University, in collaboration with the Science and Technology Facilities Council, saw its National Schools Observatory taking cutting-edge science to surprising places, including the Chelsea Flower Show. The Royal Conservatoire of Scotland created a three-year pre-HE pathway to help deaf learners to develop life and arts skills to study at the institution. And the University of West Winchester worked with a range of organisations to enhance the support provision for the nearly 400,000 young adult carers in the UK struggling to balance this role with their studies. Which one came out on top? Mary, please tell us. Thank you for the kiss.
It's all a bit tense now.
UCAS is delighted to sponsor the Widening Participation and Outreach Initiative of the Year, and the winner is the University of Winchester.
Oh,
welcome to the stage, Winchester's Assistant Vice
How does that happen? How the fuck? I'll demand a recount, I can't tell ya. What the fucking hell's gone on there? I'm fucking fuming. Absolutely fuming. What a piss take.
Huge congratulations once again to Winchester.
Yeah, fucking. How can I put this out as a fucking podcast? Ah, for fuck's sake. At the Oscars, they're always smiling. I'm like, fucking bastard. Okay, so it's the evening after the night before. You know, I finally got over the disappointment of not winning, or the, you know, Open Book Project not winning in the category of WP. Good luck to University of Winchester, and congratulations on their award. One thing I have to say is that, you know, we had a good laugh last night. And in typical Open Book fashion, you know, half the table drunk, half the table teetotal, and, you know, abused all the other universities there. After not winning, you know, there was a feeling that we should have gone all Millwall on their arse, and, you know, I upturned the table and called it on, you know. Phoned the Conservatoire Scotland and told them to meet us at Euston Station for a tear-up. But apparently they don't do that in higher education. And I think that's where, you know, universities are going wrong. There's not enough football violence in UK universities. But there you go. I mean, you know, we're trying to bring a bit of working class culture to UK university life, and I can't think for one moment why they don't want us. More in a while. Okay, I hope you enjoyed this sort of short episode, looking at a week in the life of Open Book. I'm sure next year will be an even better year for the project, and exciting times for us, because next year we launch our sort of pilot foundation degree course, an Open Book degree course, which you know, it's sort of really groundbreaking in both its conception and its delivery, and it's a degree which a foundation degree which can be done by anybody, whether you're in a homeless shelter, or you're a full-time carer stuck at home with children, or looking after elderly parents, if you're at a youth club, if you're at a football club community scheme, yeah, it can be rolled out anywhere really. It doesn't follow the normal protocols of a traditional university foundation degree. And the concept is that you do this year's foundation degree and then you can go on to do a BA, a bachelor degree, certainly at Goldsmiths, without any real question concerning, you know, your background, your education, or your social status. So we're all excited by that one. And, you know, the hope is that one day an open book student will be able to do this degree and then be able to go to any university in the country, regardless of any of those things I mentioned, really, and regardless of being working class, because there's not enough working class people in universities. We're trying to change that. We're kicking on the doors of universities, and long may that continue. So, enough from me. Keep the faith. Up the workers. Viva Open Book. Think of us. Think of the likes of us. And I'll speak to you soon. Cheers.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow the rules. Working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. Think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.